This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Does digital activism favor conservatives? Sociologist Jean Schrade's work shows that it does. She analyzed more than 30 political groups in North Carolina. Her conclusion? Groups that are resource-rich, authoritative, and hierarchical have an advantage when it comes to online activism, and these are all typical characteristics of conservative groups. Lays it all out in the new book, The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. Jen Schrade is a professor at Sciences Po, in Paris, and she joins me maintenant.
Hello.
Good to see you. So why did you decide to dig into digital activism this way?
Yes. So I am generally a scholar on this very broad idea of digital democracy. So I had been doing a lot of research on what's commonly called the digital divide, right? How some people can use the internet more than others, and found pretty substantial inequality between different classes of people with engagement online. And around 2010, 2011, there was at that point a lot of talk of how these new technologies would really revolutionize revolutions, so to speak, right? So we had the Arab Spring, we had Occupy Wall Street, and in 2011, Time magazine named the protester the person of the year, and digital technology was a really big piece of that. But as a scholar of digital inequality, I had some questions around that. Was who are these people really on an everyday level being able to engage in online activism? So I thought, rather than just look at these very visible movements, right, that we were seeing in the media, what about the everyday practices that social, political, and labor movement groups were engaged in? And at the time, there were most of this focus on Twitter revolutions or Facebook revolutions was really on groups more to the left, right? More progressive, radical groups. And I wanted to look at groups on both sides of the political spectrum. So I decided to kind of leave the Berkeley, San Francisco area, which didn't quite have enough of conservative folks to interview and examine, and decided to study a political issue in North Carolina, which was the perfect purple state to do that.
And talk about the issue that, or issues that you're looking at.
Sure. So the issue is collective bargaining rights for public employees. So what does that mean? So in a few states like North Carolina, teachers, firefighters, sanitation workers don't have the legal right to a union contract. Mm-hmm. You can form a union, but you don't necessarily have a right to a union contract. And this was a really great issue to look at this question of online activism, because not only was I interested in groups who were supporting and opposing an issue, but I was also interested in groups from different social classes as well. So this particular issue not only, of course, attracted people who are interested in unionizing or unions themselves, but also civil rights groups, student groups supporting the issue. But on the other side, Tea Party groups, other patriot organizations, and other folks opposing this labor issue.
And so one of the things that we think about, I mean, if you go back to the issues that got people excited about the potential for social media as a movement for change or a platform for change, they're looking at these big revolutions and that sort of thing, which we're all engaged in one way or another. Everybody knew about the Arab Spring. Who all is engaging in these conversations over labor rights? Is it just the activist groups? Are they only talking to each other and their own constituents?
Right. So that was one of the questions I had, both looking offline and online as well. And what I found was, first of all, I think you maybe have been alluding to this question of, you know, do we have these filter bubbles? Are some people on one side of the political spectrum just talking to themselves and vice versa? So I really took some time to find out, first of all, what groups were doing online with websites, with Facebook, looked at all of their Facebook usage, as well as Twitter, right? Which, you know, politicians and journalists and scholars tend to really focus on Twitter. And I wanted to look at the whole gamut. And what I found, though, was that of this, of looking at all of these groups, all 34 of these groups and over 60,000 tweets when I was doing this research, only one was from a working class group, right? So that's statistically zero. So if we're trying to gauge what's important by going to Twitter or going to other social media sites, we're really missing out on what may be happening offline.
Right. And so it's not just because much of the research that had been done up until then, and I think is still being done, is kind of counting and harvesting millions and millions of tweets to see what people are saying. But you're sort of then separating it by class. Now, we've known for a long time that there's a digital divide. In other words, if you don't have the resources, you may not have access to some of these. Although I do wonder how much of that's changing. But that's one thing. But talk more about the engagement piece and how that tends to create a differential as well.
Yeah, so exactly. Early on, when researchers first started looking at the digital divide, it was a simple question of who has access to a computer and who doesn't. And that's why it's called a divide. And now we like to use the term digital inequalities, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of differences. So that was one area of my earliest research, was I wanted to go beyond just who is consuming online content, but who is producing this content, right? And so I did find pretty substantial class gaps in that earlier research, but also found that with activism. But the other key issue, again, as you mentioned, it's more than just having the tools. What I found was that for individual activists, it's what I called assets, right? Do people have the access? A. Do they have skills? S. Do they feel empowered? E. Mm-hmm. And do they have the time to use it, right? So some of us who feel like we're tethered to, you know, our gadgets or our devices all day may feel like, oh, I wish I wasn't online all the time. Mm-hmm. But for other people who have to drive a long distance to go use the computer at their aunt's house or take a bus to the library, being able to engage online is really important. But the other piece that I found was that there is this broader question of what I like to call the fear factor, where a lot of working class folks didn't really feel comfortable posting online about what was happening in their workplace or their workplace struggles or other political issues because of the potential repression. Mm-hmm. And the problem was that at the same time, a lot of the groups that they were involved with, churches, community groups, worker centers, unions, et cetera, if they weren't online as much, then it was this kind of interaction, iterative process where they didn't necessarily feel like they had what they called a safe space to organize, right? So churches, all these community groups have always been a safe space. But because the internet is more of an individualized form of communication, if their you know, network of safety, so to speak, isn't online, it was much more challenging for people to post what could be potentially, they could potentially get a lot of repression based on what they posted.
And why would conservative groups or conservative issues be favored in this regard? Why would they have a greater online presence institutionally?
Right. So there are a number of reasons why I found that conservatives were much more likely to be engaged online. And I would see Tea Party and other activists post a picture with them holding up a gun or et cetera. So I didn't really see that fear factor that I did as much with some groups. But, a lot of conservative activists I talked to were everyday folks who were really interested in what they called spreading the truth or telling the truth. Right. So they really believed that the mainstream media wasn't really covering their issues adequately, and they wanted to get their message out. And this freedom of information was really imperative, and general ideas of freedom were really key. And they also had this very strong network of resourced organizations, think tanks, news media outlets, who were creating memes and articles that they were reposting, commenting on, et cetera, that had very straightforward, simple messages around freedom, right? And their eyes would light up when I would ask them about the internet, right? One activist said, you know, Paul Revere had a horse, we have the internet, right? For them, it was the perfect vehicle for evangelizing, for digital evangelizing,
and they
really
both produce a lot of waste, don't they? Well, anyway, go ahead. Please continue.
Yeah, no, so groups on the left, just to be simplistic in this right and left dichotomy here, overly simplistic, that rather than focusing on freedom, the left tends to focus on fairness, right, and egalitarianism. And so for groups on the left, yes, in some cases, they may not have had as many resources, but it was more than that, because I looked at some groups who did have more resources. It was also that this idea of egalitarianism is there are multiple issues, right? Whether it was LGBTQ issues, environmental issues, civil rights, workers' issues, and there were so many messages. It wasn't a simple message of, you know, we want to get rid of Obamacare, or we want something very simple and straightforward. And so you had this diverse array of messages. The organizations themselves also were more interested in organizing than evangelizing, right? And so the internet may not have always been the most effective tool to get a diverse group of people to the so-called activist table.
Well, and you can sort of imagine if the debate, if there were a sort of a digital debate over whether the Earth was flat and the sun revolved around the Earth, or it was the other way around, it'd be pretty hard for you to argue that the sun isn't going around the Earth, you know, in on Twitter. There's a very long kind of hand-waving explanation about why that isn't true, but it's a little harder to prove, I guess, in a tweet. So maybe it's something along those lines.
So I think, though, that it's important to recognize that, you know, if we're talking about this idea that's now being thrown around with the left and the right, fake news, mm-hmm. right, and what, you know, is it, are we just victims of disinformation bots by Russian trolls? And I think that in some ways, if we focus so much on those external factors or those villains, right, whether it's Putin or Zuckerberg for developing and promoting this platform, that we're really missing the systematic inequalities and differences around resources, around ideology, around organizational structures that are really key to, you know, really maintaining this digital activism gap.
Well, time is one other resource that you point to that would be a difference between, say, conservative and progressive and progressive groups. Talk more about that and the way the class divide plays into that.
Absolutely. So how time played a factor is not only individual activists, for example. There was one worker I talked to who said when he went into work, he was 25 years old, was pretty engaged online, but had to hand over his cell phone when he clocked into work for 12 hours, right? And then had to drive a long distance to get home and back to work, et cetera. So didn't have that time to always be online. The other way that that really factors into is that I found that it really takes for social movement and labor and political groups, it takes a dedicated person to really have the expertise and the time to understand the algorithms of social media and to really understand what works and to follow up, right? So we have this idea that anyone can just post a viral tweet or video and then it just spontaneously happens. But I really found the opposite of that. It really takes hierarchical organizational structures and really bureaucracy to make this happen. But it wasn't just paid staff people, although that was really important to generate a lot of online participation. It was also, for example, retired Tea Party activists who had a lot of time on their hands. And so it was an interesting finding that, older folks like Tea Party activists were much more likely to have high levels of online engagement than some of the younger student activists that I also interviewed.
Well, and getting back to the cost of the infrastructure, it's not just paying the person or the people to keep track of it all, but you have to pay for the analytics. So it's one thing to spout your opinion, and if we have thousands of people spouting an opinion or maybe just trying to organize a march quickly, that's one thing. But if you really want to manipulate public opinion, then you have to pay for analytics so that you can fine-tune the message, and that costs money. And again, we associate that more with conservative groups who have more of that.
Absolutely. And so, right, on the one hand, you have to understand how, for example, the algorithm works with Facebook. But yeah, you have to have the resources to pay Facebook, for example, to promote your post, or pay for, Twitter bots, for example. But again, I think it's those resources are important, but there are also digital boots on the ground that are also key to this, who they're individuals who have maybe not a ton of money. So I'm not trying to argue that it's, conservatives who are very wealthy per se, who are the puppet masters of this. But that, yes, there are resourced organizations that are providing some of this information and training for activists. But that just everyday conservatives, activists that I talked to had some digital savvy and understanding and maybe an educational background. Some of the leaders that I talked to had master's degrees or even a PhD as well.
And you did. And again, this is where your research differs from some of the other research that's been done. You spent a lot of time talking to the people who were involved in these movements and who are engaged online. You gave us a hint earlier. You said when you talk with conservatives, their eyes tended to light up. So what happens when you talk to progressives and working folk about their hopes for and aspirations about the internet?
So a lot of progressive and more left-leaning activists I talked to often said, oh, I wish we could do more. I wish we had someone who could update our website. I talked to one activist who said he had been trained on how to update their website, but they're so busy doing other forms of organizing and activism that by the time he went to follow up on that training, he had just forgotten, right? So folks on the left just tended to feel more scattered rather than having more of the focused energy put toward digital activism.
So is this a matter for public policy? Is it a public policy question, or is this just another sort of market issue that we're going to have to deal with?
So I think that if we imagine that the way to solve the digital activism gap is by tweaking the platforms, right? So Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg have been in the news a lot lately for a variety of problems and challenges around speech and hate speech on the platform. But I think we're kind of looking in the wrong direction because, as I said, the biggest source of this digital activism gap are these social class issues. So one key policy issue could be around digital literacy and really looking beyond just basic access, although that's really key and important, but really looking at the question of skills and, providing more opportunities for people to participate online. Because if, a lot of ways to get involved in politics now, you have to go to a website, you have to sign up online to speak to your city council member. And again, I think we might be missing a lot of voices if we rely on digital technology to count whose opinions matter in today's society.
Jen Schrade is an author, the author of The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. She is a professor at Sciences Po in Paris, and she's going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight at 7 o'clock, and you can get that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Jen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, a whimsical swing band, Queen Bee and the Honey Lovers. You'll have to hear it to believe it. Stay tuned.